me from inches away. I dropped my eyes, said nothing, did nothing. Even as his hand traveled down my back and possessively squeezed my ass. How much? Not this man, not this man. I'd take 1,000 clipboard questions and beg for my keeper's touch before I served this man.
15,000.
15,000? I almost lifted my head, almost broke character and stared at my keeper. That is all I was worth. That is what the training and hell was for? To increase my value to the point where my skin fetched the price of a used fucking Camry? That's too much, the man drawled, his fingers moving across my ass cheeks and digging into the crack. I bit the inside of my cheek and struggled not to speak.
12.
My master spoke too quickly and I wanted to scream. 12,000? I had 12,000 in my savings account at home. Was fairly certain that Brett would pay 100 times that amount without hesitation. This could not be my ending. I wouldn't let it happen. I raised my head and stared into the man's eyes, the action unexpected, his eyes narrowing in response. Then I licked my Revlon super lustrous number 680 temptress lips and spoke. Get your fucking hands off of me, or so help me God, I will break every one of your fingers. Beside me, my keeper jerked into action, his hand clamping down on my arm harder than I'd ever felt it. The punishment in the bite of every single finger. I fought it, stared into the man's eyes and let him see every ounce of hatred in my heart. Behind us, a voice so low and deep that it stopped us all. The casual authority 100 levels above the three of us.
Is there a problem here?
5 words that gripped my heart and smashed it into place. 5 words spoken in a manner I'd never heard, yet instantly recognized. 5 words that caused both men to turn, but I stayed in place. A tremble starting from my feet and rocketing up till I thought I'd drop. Till I thought right there on that floor that I would burst into 100 pieces. Brett had found me. I pressed my lips together and fought the breakage of my soul, my eyes squeezing together, a lump in my throat fighting to burst through every opening in my soul. I had been saved.
Chapter 62. The trio of black SUVs were ahead of us, my app verifying Brett's location in the car.
Very James Bond, the driver called out cheerfully, lifting his chin and meeting my gaze in the rearview mirror.
Uh-huh.
I gripped the front passenger headrest and stared at the cars, watched as we wound through downtown. Brett's friends, the men from the house, now here, with 2 extra SUVs, headed into the heart of the city. Not going on a boat sales call, that was for certain. They must work for him, be part of the drug operation. I wondered at his house, at all of the rooms that we had passed through, made love in. How many of those rooms had closets full of drugs, or guns, or both? How many nights had I sat in a hotel room while he had destroyed lives, broken 100 laws, empowered terrorist and drug organizations? I had seen enough. I should go back to the hotel, book a flight home and be halfway to the airport by the time Brett returned.
You getting out now?
I raised my head, looked around, scrambling into action when I realized that the brigade before us had stopped, doors opening on all 3 vehicles, 2 men I didn't recognize joining Brett's foursome. I glanced at the meter and pulled out a 20, holding it out. Keep the change. What is this place? He twisted in his seat, taking the cash with an appreciative nod.
A salsa club, real popular with the tourists, but it's early, won't be too crazy right now. It'll heat up in an hour or so, be really crazy then. Want me to wait for you?
I glanced around, Brett's entourage entering through the front, the street quiet and relatively clean. No, I think I'm okay. Taxis come through here often?
Oh yes, every few minutes. But here's my card. If you can't find one, just give me a call.
He smiled, half his grin void of teeth. I took the card. Thanks. I was slow to exit, a group of girls approaching the club, and I waited for them to pass before stepping out. I followed them closely, an attempt to hide, a barrage of Spanish bouncing between them as they pulled open the doors and shouted a chorus of welcomes to the doorman. They were my shield, camouflaging my entrance, and my eyes darted around the dim interior quickly, worried that I would turn around and bump into Brett's chest. I had nothing and everything to worry about. The group of men wasn't there. I paid the doorman and hugged the shadows, checking the room once, twice, three times. I visited the restrooms, put my ear to the men's room door, wandered behind the bandstand and out to the patio. The cabbie was right. The place wasn't busy. Nothing like the mosh pit of the Jamaican club.
Looking for someone?
The man's voice made me jump, my nerves fried, and I spun around, gripping my elbow with a wince when it connected solidly with the edge of a table. No, not really. I tried to smile, shook out the arm.
You just look lost.
He stepped back, giving me space, and I relaxed a bit, took in his dark polo and khakis. You work here? He shrugged.
You could call it that. I own the club. My name's Mitchell.
He extended a hand. Riley, I smiled. Is there more to it? It seems bigger from the outside. He glanced left, in the direction of a door marked private.
There's an upstairs, but it's closed to a private party.
Closed to a private party. I rubbed my elbow, my arm tingling from the hit. You know what kind of party it is? I should give up. Take a seat in the corner and wait for them to leave. Or get out of here. He grinned.
I could get you in if you are interested.
Am I interested? No, probably not. Chances are he'll open the door and it'll be a flashback to my experience at Brett's home office, staring blankly at a group of men with no logical purpose for my presence. No, I was just curious.
Why don't you come up to VIP? It has a view of the upstairs, plus one of the city.
VIP? I hadn't seen a VIP in my cruise of the club. Then again, I hadn't seen the stairway upstairs, but Brett and his cronies had gone somewhere. Are there other people in VIP? He laughed.
Where do you think everyone is? There's a reason it's a ghost town down here.
I watched him laugh, the easy tilt of his head, the relaxed sag of his shoulders, the nod he gave to a waitress when she passed. He was nice, helpful, a little flirtatious, but that was fine. Trustworthy, connected, and he could give me a glimpse of the upstairs party. I smiled. Sounds good.
Chapter 63. Kitten. The five fingers of him burned into my arm. The twist of his body to look at Brett, causing a rug burn effect. But I stayed in place, my back to him. I couldn't turn, couldn't look into Brett's eyes, because if I did, God, if I saw his face, my barely controlled emotions would flood. I would sob his name, throw my arms out and fly into his chest. I would grip his shirt, smell his cologne, and never let go. They'd have to cut out our chests and separate the beating of our hearts.
No problem, just a little negotiation over price. The slave stepped out of place.
He jerked with his hand on my arm, and I stumbled around, into my keeper, my eyes glued to the floor, the wet brim of tears threatening to fall as I did everything to stop myself from looking up. Brett's shoes, black dress shoes, the laces tight and neat. If I pulled up his dress pants, I'd see dark silk socks. He watched me, a playful gleam in his eyes as he pulled his shoes, then his socks off, stretching the black fabric between his hands and standing. Walking to the foot of the bed, he grabbed my ankles and pulled me to the edge, winking at me before he pinned them together and secured them with the silk. "What are you going to do?" I breathed, testing the bind. His weight settling on the bed as he moved against me,
and propped my bound legs against his shoulder.
"Just wait,"
he ordered, his hands busy unbuckling his belt.
"The negotiation is over."
Brett's voice was quiet yet carried, and I counted the shoes around him. 3 other pairs, all pointed this way. I wondered about the men attached to them, if they were ones I'd met before. Wondered how much of his life that I had misunderstood had revolved around this.
"Actually,"
the fat man beside me spoke, stepped forward a bit.
"It's not, but you're welcome to enter the deal. I might be persuaded to sell my option."
In the silence that followed, I pictured Brett's face, the way his jaw clenched when he held back anger, the way his eyes blazed with authority, when his words finally came. I heard the pent-up bite in their tones.
"Do you know who I am?"
It was an odd response, and I stopped counting shoes and remembering and holding back tears. Stopped everything to listen. My keeper spoke.
"I'd guess, from the room's sudden silence, that you're buyer 43.
He was right. The room was quiet. The hum of masculinity, the laughs and murmurs and feminine chimes, all had stopped. There was nothing more interesting in this space than us. Buyer 43. I tried to remember what had been said.
"I suggest you make Buyer 43's acquaintance. He's always looking for American girls to purchase, though he typically breaks them himself. He's here. I've heard his name before. He rarely misses a sale."
I shifted, returned my gaze to Brett's shoes, waited for his response. Always looking for American girls. He has been looking for me.
"That is correct. This one. She's American?" "Yes, and well-trained."
My keeper practically chirped the response. I stared at my own feet, the cheap heels on them. The type of heels I wore when I met Brett. Not the kind he deserved. "I am well-trained."
"What price are you thinking?"
The fat man put a hand on my shoulder, his fingers spreading and squeezing the skin, leaving a moist print I would probably never fully rub off. He almost bought me.
"I'm thinking that you get your hand off of her and step a fucking way before I cut off that hand myself."
The hand left. So did the man. I could almost feel the brush of air as he found his common sense and left. My master's words practically jump out, a rush of run-on syllables that melded together into a string of pathetic.
"I'm a big fan of yours. Heard about you for years. I'm glad we got the chance to meet. It was really more than I expected, you being here tonight. What is it that you respect?"
Brett said coolly.
"My purchasing habits? My stable?" "Everything. I'd love to see your facility, watch you train. I heard you take all types." "My hobby is not a theme park. You can't come and wander around, eat fucking popcorn, and watch me work the girls."
He straightens, shifts in response, and I feel the cold, possessive slide of his hand down the back of my arm and around my waist.
"It was nice to meet you. A big honor."
He pulled on my waist, moving me a step towards him, the hurt kid taking his toys and going home.
"The band on your arm indicates you're here to buy."
Brett's voice interrupts our exit.
"I am. You know I have hundreds. Tell me what you are interested in. Or, since you have such an interest in my dealings, come and pick one out."
A slight release. The turn of him back to Brett.
"And what about her?"
He tips his head toward me.
"You like American girls? Do you want to do a trade? I'll give you 20 for the girl now. You can use it to rebuy tonight, or save it for your trip to my ranch."
I was so close to freedom. I wish I could pin my eyes in place, the danger of them lifting so strong. Brett sounded so calm, so smooth,
was playing the game better than I ever would have been able to. 25?
I may faint if this negotiation lasts much longer.
No.
Brett's voice was cold.
Take the deal or get the fuck out of my sight.
The man beside me laughed, high and awkwardly,
his step passing in front of my line of vision, my gaze lifting slightly to see their hands shake.
We have a deal. Enjoy her.
I feel the push of my keeper's, ex-keeper's hand, and step forward. I can't lift my eyes or I will break. Am stepping over the edge to freedom. Cannot lose this now.
Come here.
It is not Brett who speaks. It's the man on his left who holds out his hand, and I step towards him, my hands clasped, daring to raise my head and meet his gaze. It is strong and steady, a hard jaw, kind eyes. I know this man. Met him at Brett's house, the full introduction made in the outdoor kitchen, him setting down tongs long enough to shake my hand and give me his name. I can't remember it, but know that he had two kids, one who played soccer. He smiled at me, but I was too scared to respond. Wanted to be out of this party as soon as possible. Wanted to scrub my skin until I removed every layer of him. Wanted to be alone with Brett and burrow into his chest, look into his face and rediscover every detail I'd struggled to memorize. Never let go of him. I heard the slap of a handshake behind me, money exchanged, a string of subservient words pouring at Brett from the man who had demanded obedience from me. Heard or imagined the click of his shoe as he stepped away. Felt the close of a hand. Brett's hand, around my arm as he gently pushed me forward, steering me toward the door. His voice low and urgent when he turned to the others.
Make sure we get to the car safely, then stay here and deal with the other girls. I'll meet you back at the house.
It took 1,000 steps to reach the street, his hand firmly wrapped around my bare bicep, every bit of my skin obsessed with the warm grip of him. 1,000 steps where, at one moment, turning a corner, he leaned down and pressed a kiss on the top of my shoulder, inhaled a deep breath and smelled me, moved the thumb of his hand gently and caressed the underside of my arm for one moment, before we rounded the edge and he was, again, pure business. When we stepped past polished shoes, I took in a shuddering breath. When a hand pushed on the door and it opened, a burst of free air greeting us, the night outside quiet, an SUV ahead of us waiting, the back door opened by a faceless man. I exhaled, stepped up into the warm vehicle. The driver turned in his seat, his face flinching in surprise when our eyes connected, recognition hitting us both at the same time. Another meeting, another time, another friend. The door shut behind Brett. The truck accelerated away from the house, and I felt the crush of his arms around me. He gripped me as if he was drowning, his arms wrapping around me, his head in my neck, breath gasping as if he was broken, a quivering sob of racking inhalations. The action paused only by his kisses, quick and soft against my shoulder, collarbone, neck. He moved a shaky hand to either side of my face and held it, still, his lips pressing to mine before he pulled away, and I looked fully into his face for the first time in the rest of my life. Saw heartbreak there that rivaled my own. Need and stress. A man aged in my time away. His fingers trembling as he ran the pads of digits across my lips.
I thought.
He shuddered out of breath.
I thought you were gone. Oh my God.
He sobbed, a wet, shaky inhale, his hands sliding into my curls and gripping them, pulling me closer. I dug my hands into his hair and pulled him toward me, our lips meeting, and knew in that moment that nothing between us, not with the time or the separation or my servitude, had changed. He didn't see me as ruined or used. He gripped me like I was priceless, kissed me like he'd never let go. He was still mine. We were still us.
Chapter 64. Whatever he had injected me with, I had my senses about me when he lifted my arm, threw it over his shoulder and propped me up on my feet. walked us both past the bathrooms, through the dim hall and back into the club. The floor more crowded, a colorful swirl before me. I tried to reach out a hand, to grab a person, tried to open my mouth and scream for help, tried to do something other than close my eyes and slump against him. I heard his laugh, heard words I couldn't understand, saw the door open, the night dark. My taxi, where was my taxi? I twisted a floppy ankle on the cobblestone streets, pulled against him, and felt his hand tighten, to a point of pain. This was bad. I tried to yell for Brett, tried to lift my head and look up, to the VIP. Private party. And I wondered for a minute, through the haze, if he was like Brett, a drug trafficker. Maybe I would be a mule, maybe I would. He threw me in the back seat of a car and shut the door, the hard motion slamming at the bottom of my heel, my knee popping up, my face against a cold vinyl seat. I tried to finish my thought, tried to move my mouth to ask a question, tried to... couldn't... black. Chapter 65. Kitten.
Oh my God, I thought you were gone.
Brett pulled his lips off of mine, long enough to whisper the words. The press of his lips against my forehead, warm and soft, and him. I would never again have to be in that cell. I would never again have to look into that man's eyes, or feel his fists, or answer his questions. I was no longer a slave. I was free. My mind choked on that final concept, and I pulled away, his eyes widening, his pursuit of me halted as he held himself back. I pulled at the neck of the cheap dress, it choking me, the scratch of its polyester against my bare skin, hot and lingering and maddening. I have to get this off, I blurted out, craning my body, trying to reach for a zipper, the act ripping a hole through my awareness, the pain in my side flaring for one searing moment. Ow! Sudden tears. They gave me no warning, just came. A drip of them down my cheek as my hands grew frantic, trying to unzip something that some sadist designed just out of reach.
Here.
His hands soft but efficient, the relieving sound of the zipper, the loosening of the dress, and I yanked at it, freeing my upper half. Brett's quick move off the seat, shedding his jacket, the smooth feel of his suit's lining sliding around me, my arms wiggling into his sleeves. I kicked off the dress with the cheap heels and watched it settle onto the floorboard, towed off the shoes and watched black soles and silk straps join the dress. Curled into Brett's chest and let his arms come around me, his head dropping to mine. I was dirty. He would need to burn this jacket, this truck, everything associated with this event. I love you. I whispered the words that I had said 1,000 times into my empty cell, imagining this moment, imagining his smell, his kiss, the desperate relief that I just saw in his eyes. I got all of those things, and it took 5 minutes for me to remember to say, I love you.
Oh my God, Riley.
His hands cupped underneath my bare legs, pulled me onto his lap as he inhaled my scent, and placed a long kiss against my lips.
I love you too. I love you so much.
Riley. I had thought, for long nights in the cell, that I would never hear that name again. Had coveted thoughts of it, like a fantasy I was scared to indulge. I pulled at him, needed more of his kiss, more of his contact, more of the sound of my name on his lips. Riley. Never again would I be subservient, lost, dead. I was alive, free, with Brett, his mouth warm and gentle against my own. My head spun as I tried to process it all, the hope I had held on to for so long. It had happened. I pulled off his mouth and gulped in air, shook against the strength of his hands. For a moment, I couldn't breathe. Never again would I be kitten.
Chapter 66. Brett. When Elise disappeared, I was asleep, in my home in Fort Lauderdale. I slept right through the moment when, in a nightclub, she collapsed. Most of her bachelorette party was on the upper floor of the club, drinking martinis around a private table. Elise and her best friend left the group to go downstairs to dance. Those nearby said that Elise collapsed on the dance floor and was taken away by a doctor and a helpful bystander, Brittany glued to her unconscious side. Everyone assumed they were taken to a hospital. Only Elise and Brittany never made it to one. They never made it anywhere. My phone rang right before dawn, a bridesmaid's voice nervously coming through the receiver. She let me know what had happened. I was on a plane within the hour, in a Mexican police station by 7 a.m., 6 hours too late. That day cracked the foundation of my life, my soul. The day her body was found destroyed me, a piece of my being gone forever, lost into the cruelty that was this world. I thought, on that day, that I had experienced the worst loss of my life, that if I ever crawled out of my hole of despair, I'd be a stronger man for it, that I'd be tougher, smarter. Elise's death had destroyed me. Riley's disappearance. I almost took my life in those days. Had her body turned up in the Mexican desert, I would have. The only thing that kept me alive, kept me breathing, was my mission to find and save her. I wasn't the same man who had searched for Elise. I was smarter, more connected, savvier. I was also more ruthless. That night in Puerto Vallarta, when Riley had followed me, I was buying girls. Had gone, not upstairs, as Menas had mentioned to Riley, downstairs, into the basement of the club, a giant space that housed over 100 women. I bought 13 that night. Climbed back up the stairs into that salsa club, proud, happy. Glanced at my watch as I re-entered the club. It was still early. She'd be up, waiting for me. And I suddenly couldn't wait to see her. I didn't know that she was already an hour away in the trunk of that asshole's car. I walked out of that club a naive individual. Walked into the hotel still clueless. Didn't even understand it when I walked into an empty hotel suite, her satellite phone on the bedside table. It took me another hour to fully comprehend it, the moment when I fully accepted it. It was a punch hard into my chest, a punch that broke through bone and gripped my heart and squeezed so hard that I physically ached. I fell onto my knees in the middle of the Puerto Vallarta police station and sobbed like a child. I broke into pieces on that dirty linoleum floor. Then I called my men. In the 9 months of Riley's disappearance, I killed 3 men in my search for her. I wasn't proud of that fact, but trust me, they were men who deserved to die. I wanted to kill this man as well, wanted nothing more than to physically rip him apart with my hands. But that would be Riley's decision to make. I couldn't weigh her down with my sins, wouldn't burden her with the guilt that I would always carry. Elise's disappearance hadn't been my fault. Riley's had. I was the sole reason she was in that salsa club, the sole reason she was alone in that dangerous country without protection. 9 days would have been too long, much less 9 months. I didn't know how to take that time back. Didn't know how I would love her the rest of her life without smothering her. Because honestly, all I wanted to do for the rest of my life was protect her. Never leave her side. Love her. Treasure her. Marry her. Make her smile. Hear her laugh. Love her sweetly, deeply, and into forever. I watched her sleep and wanted to touch her, but worried I would crush her with my love.
Chapter 67. Carlos Menas made it 5 steps out of the building, a new slave by his side, when he was taken. The girl was put into one black SUV, he in the other, accompanied by 3 men. Men who had spent the last 4 years in Brett's employ. Men who rescued 1,000 girls from men like him. Men who had killed before and put no value on his life. At the house, an oceanfront mansion rented for the trip, Brett drew me a bath, climbed in behind me and held me when I cried, brought in a team of chefs, a doctor, and a masseuse, all of which were unnecessary. I wanted only to be in his arms, nothing else. The next morning, we climbed up the steps and onto his jet, heading straight home to my family. Jenna had been right, sitting in my kitchen eons ago. The jet was twice as big, twice as luxurious as the plane I had always taken. 100 questions and confirmations that could all wait for later. I settled into the seat, my hand in his, and didn't know. Didn't realize that back in Puerto Vallarta, Brett's team tracked down Carlos Menaz's car, moved him from their SUV into the trunk, drove him back across the border, straight to the address listed on his vehicle registration, a home 30 miles outside of Albuquerque, forcibly returned him to his home, leaving him chained in the basement, in a cell that had, less than 72 hours before, belonged to Kitten. Me. Then they called Brett. We were in my parents' living room when the call came. Unbeknownst to me, Brett had become close with my family during the 9 months of my capture, had flown 20 times between Lauderdale and Quincy, trusted my father with information he had never shared with me, kept him apprised to the buying trips, to the slaves rescued, to the women, none of which were me. They hadn't known what had happened to me, hadn't been certain that I was taken for the slave trade. Yet Brett had doubled his efforts there. My father had come to Cancun, and they had watched hotel security footage, had tracked down my helpful cabbie, had spoken to employees of the salsa club. No one remembered me or reported sightings of the man. We had both, in the events of that night, been unmemorable enough to have never existed. When Brett's phone rang, he glanced at the display, then at my father. I caught the look that passed, noticed the curl of my father's fingers against his pant leg when Brett stood up and excused himself, his voice low when he brought the phone to his ear. My father's leg jumped, a nervous jiggle, and I wasn't surprised when he stood up, his hurried steps carrying him outside to the patio, my eyes following them. "Are you okay?" My mother's hand touched my arm and I jumped, my gaze skipping to her, the pained look at my response twisting my gut. I smiled and hoped it looked normal. "Yes, Mom, I'm just glad to be home." "God, when I think of what you must have been through." Her hand trembled when she covered her mouth, and I noticed the absence of polish on her nails. She'd always worn polish, gets it done on Tuesdays after work, her standard appointment. I suddenly picked up on the other details. The gray at her roots, the dead cigarettes in the ashtray. I was gone for 9 months, and my mother fell apart. My heart squeezed at the realization. I reached out and clasped her hand, gripped it firmly. "It wasn't what you think, Mom. He wasn't bad, honestly. He was a psychology freak, liked to ask questions. That was most of it." She swallowed and gripped my hand, ran her other one over the top of our clasp, her cold fingers tracing the lines of my veins. "I can see your bruises, Riley, your winces. I can hear the change in your breaths, the pain in your voice. I am, though I haven't always been the best, your mother." I bit my bottom lip and tried not to cry. "You are the best mother I could ever want." "No," she said softly, "but I'll try harder to be." The kitchen door slammed shut, and I looked up to see two sets of grim faces. "Riley," my father said, "forgive my interruption, but we need to make a decision, and I think you should be involved." Chapter 68, 1 month after rescue. When Brett was born, he was the first of two. Two hearts, two sets of chubby hands, two kicking and screaming sets of skin that burst into the world as the two Betchart heirs, impossible babies born to a barren mother, an early miracle of in vitro before the practice was common. They spent the first 10 months of their lives in a space no bigger than a basketball, and they came out inseparable. The day I met Brett, his heart was already taken. He'd given it to a 6-year-old girl who let his G.I. Joes kidnap her Barbies. A 15-year-old who'd sacrificed her best friend to his heartbreaking ways. An 18-year-old high school senior who had begged him to stay local, then sent him care packages every other weekend when he went to Duke. A girl who, at 30 years old, disappeared while at a friend's bachelorette party in Cancun. A girl whose remains were found 2 years later in the Nevada desert. I stood at her grave and stared down at the headstone of Elise Marine Betchart, dug my toes against the leather of my sandals and smelled fresh-cut grass. Wondered if she smelled freedom before she died, if it was in an attempt to escape, or if she died in a cell. Wondered, in her days of pain, if she, like me, held on to thoughts of Brett. Let's go. Brett's fingers threaded through my own. His gentle pull brought my forehead to his lips. I closed my eyes and appreciated the moment, the tickle of my hair against my throat, the smell of him when he let go of my hand and wrapped his arms around my torso, pulled me to his chest. We stood there for a moment, the beat of his heart against my ear, the fuzz of his sweater the softest thing against my cheek I could ever imagine. I had worried, some sleepless nights in that cell, that I'd cringe from his touch, that the experiences I'd undergone would scar my psyche in ways unrecoverable, that one day I'd escape, yet always be imprisoned by that hell. My fear had lifted the first time Brett had touched me, kissed me, cried my name while cradling me in his arms. He was nothing like that man. His touch, nothing like his bite. His words a galaxy away. His love a strength that would protect me until I died. Okay, I said, and let him lead me to the car. Chapter 69. 3 months after rescue. Good morning, Miss Johnson. Good morning. Welcome to Fort Lauderdale. Thank you. I crossed my legs, then remembered some article about it causing varicose veins, and uncrossed them. Varicose veins? Why the hell was I thinking about that? I smoothed a crease on my new pants. They were a size 6. I'd never worn a size 6. I'd always been more in the 12 or 14 range. But 9 months of a slave's diet put me into this territory, into this body. A body I would have once killed to have, and now wanted nothing to do with. I missed my curves. So did Brett. He was trying to feed me at every opportunity, yet nothing was happening. It was like my body was resistant, not letting me move past this moment in time just yet. Are you settled in? I shrugged. Looked up into the woman's eyes. You can call me Riley. She smiled. Okay, Riley. You can call me Nicole. I needed my name. Needed to hear it as much as possible. I had the irrational desire to become a teeny bopper and plaster it on every surface. This morning I wrote it onto the tag of all my new clothes, like I did when I was 11 and went away to camp. Then I went down to breakfast, the scratch of my name tag comforting on my neck. I told Brett, over eggs and potatoes, that I wanted a tattoo, the script of my name along the inside of my wrist, so I could look down at any moment and see it, so that if I ever got taken again, I could hold up my hand and stare into his face and say, "Look, I am not Kitten. I am Riley." And never again would I wonder, and neither would anyone else. Are you settled in? She worked for Brett, this doctor. Worked for the organization that he had secretly run since Elise died. Brett asked me to meet with her and to give him my opinion. To see if I thought she was effective and a good fit for the rescued slaves. But I knew why I was really here. And I understood that. I thought that, despite the face I showed Brett and my parents, I needed this. I reached for the glass of water on the side table, took a sip before answering her. Yes, I think so. Fort Lauderdale is very different than Quincy, It's been an adjustment. But I'm not sure if I'm adjusting more to being back in the real world, or if it's adjusting to the move. Why did you move so quickly? You could have stayed in Quincy longer. I shook my head. I couldn't go back to work when I got back. I just couldn't. Couldn't sit across from someone and discuss a savings account when I had just been. I tried to, but it all seemed so trivial. And without work, I just had no purpose. Was just there, taking up space. And Brett was here, helping. I straightened my shoulders. I think it's healing, to help with the girls. It has meaning. I understand how it's helped him to heal from Elise, and I think it will help me heal. Does that make sense? She leaned forward and gripped my hand. Absolutely. She smiled sadly. And I absolutely understand it. I broke the eye contact and looked down at our clasped hands, noting, with a jolt of surprise, the scars on her wrists. Not that of a suicide attempt. I rolled my wrist over, the same wrist I planned to tattoo, and compared our similar handcuff scars. I squeezed her hand and looked back up to her eyes. My mouth returned her smile, but inside, my heart cried. Chapter 70. 4 months after rescue. Ms. Johnson, do you understand that you are here of your own free will and are under no obligation to make this statement?
I nodded. I do.
I have a series of questions to ask. One's to verify the verbal statement you just provided, after which time you will write a written narrative of your events. Do you understand?
I do.
On October 12th, you visited the Sendez Salsa Club in Puerto Vallarta. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why were you alone in the city at night?
I was just wasting time. Brett, my boyfriend, was having a business dinner.
And in the Salsa Club, you were approached by Carlos Menaz, who took you into a secluded area of the club and injected you with some form of drug? Is that correct?
Yes.
And your next memory was awakening in handcuffs and ankle shackles in the basement of his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Is that correct?
It is.
How long were you in Mr. Menaz's care?
I was a prisoner of Carlos Menaz until I escaped about 9 months later. It would have been 268 hatch marks.
And you escaped on July 7th in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico? Is that correct?
Yes. He had taken me there to sell me and purchase another slave.
And you escaped his care and ran to a hotel, where you called your prior boyfriend, Brett Betchart?
Yes.
And Brett Betchart just happened to be in the same city.
I was taken from there. I'm sure he made many trips there since my disappearance to look for me. My lawyer, a suit with a Yale diploma on his wall, leaned forward, far enough to catch my eye, and gave me a warning look. Oh, right. No elaborating. I forgot. I flicked my eyes back toward the man, an FBI agent.
Why didn't you call the police upon your return to America?
I called my father. He's the chief of police in my town.
So you called your father and told him where Mr. Menaz lived?
Not initially. I was in shock.
What is your understanding of what your father did with that information?
I believe that he went to New Mexico and coordinated with local authorities there.
Would you be surprised to know that your father did not contact the police, but instead went straight to Mr. Menaz's house, where it appears he tortured the man for several days before surrendering him to police?
Would I be surprised?
Yes.
No, I would not be surprised. But I don't know what my father did when he left Quincy.
Or Brett.
They left together, 3 days after I returned home. 3 days spent in a combination of smothering me with love and grilling me about my stay. I didn't want to know what they did to him. Yet a small part of me wanted every painful detail. They let him live, I knew that. They let him live, and now he was in the custody of the New Mexico judicial system.
Thank you for your cooperation, Ms. Johnson. Special Agent Haster will escort you to a private room for your written statement.
I nodded and rose, remembered at the last minute that I could look him in the eye. Chapter 71. 4 months, 3 weeks after rescue. I blew into the snow and it poofed, 100 snowflakes bursting into the air, the wind sweeping a blast of them back into my face, and I giggled, wiping a gloved hand over my ski mask. I looked around for Brett, the canvas of white before me blank and uninterrupted. Behind me, the glow of the cabin beckoned, the interior lights illuminating the cozy interior through the huge expanse of windows. I let out a long breath, the act frosting in the air before me, and looked up into the night sky. Out here, a galaxy above me, my view fringed with snow-capped branches and falling flurries, I feel oomph. I stagger back, spitting out snow as I bat at my mask, the reaction futile as I am hit with another snowball, my twisting defense causing me to fall, one big awkward pile of fleece, my feet going up, gloved hands struggling to scrape at the snow, to form my own missile in which to destroy my opponent.
Easy there.
Brett's voice, his hot breath, warms my ear in the moment before he tackles me, pinning my arms and rolling with me down the slight hill. We roll to a stop, his mouth stealing a frigid kiss against an exposed patch of neck.
If you hit me with one of those, I'll be forced to withhold hot chocolate.
I dropped the partially formed snowball and held up my hands, grinning at him. A highly effective threat. I surrender.
Promise?
He tilts his head at me suspiciously.
You'll be mine, forever and ever?
Forever and ever, I whisper, as long as that sentence comes with hot chocolate. His mouth twitches, and he lets out a troubled sigh.
I can't promise hot chocolate.
He pushes off and offers me his hand.
But I do have this.
He pulls me to my feet, us doing a seesaw when I write, and he drops onto one knee, his other hand lifting and holding out a ring box.
Riley, will you marry me?
When I gasp, there is a cloud of smoke, and through it, I see his smile.
I can't open it with these damn gloves,
he says sheepishly. I drop to my knees before him and wrap my arms around him. Yes, I say, in a giant marshmallow hug of material. I don't need to see it. Yes. He squeezes me so tightly I laugh, his arms managing to lift us both up to standing.
Forever?
He asks, setting me down and stepping back, pulling me up the hill, towards the house. Through the glass, I see my girls, a few nosy ones at the window, their hands cupping the glass, Chelsea in the background holding up a champagne bottle. Brett's friends, the same men who were there the night I was rescued, are scattered throughout the room. One, I squint, mid-kiss with Megan. I stifle a smile and turn back to my future husband. Yes, Brett, forever. He pumps his fist in the air, and everyone inside jumps up and cheers, the muffled cry passing through the glass to us. I jog a few steps, catching up, and let him pull me against his side. The word tight has 22 definitions, but my favorite is Webster's fifth, a bond which cannot be broken. We had survived secrets, suspicions, and separation, and perhaps been strengthened by all of it in some ways. Once he broke down and told me about Elise, it all made sense. My suspicions found their answers, and he found my trust. Now we had no secrets, and a vow to never keep any. He had saved me from hell and healed me back to life, all in less than 2 years. We were one unit, and not only could our bond not be broken, it would only strengthen with time. Chapter 72. 1 year, 5 months after rescue. I spent the last week before my imprisonment thinking that Brett was running drugs. Spent the first few months in Carlos Menaz's basement of the same opinion. Somewhere in between the sessions and the erosion of my mind, I stopped thinking about the bad and focused only on the good. I stopped caring whether Brett was involved in an illegal drug ring and started caring only about us, whether our love was strong enough, whether he would love me for me, whether the teeth that had been pulled from my jaw reached him and my father, or whether they simply settled into the kitchen trash of Menaz's home, a lesson in psychology and nothing more. The police did find my teeth in their search of his home. They were bagged, tagged, and put in neat order next to the other exhibits. Photos of me, recordings, my sketches, my early journal entries, everything laid out in perfect organization next to his interviews. It made a stunning exhibit at his trial. Carlos Menaz ended up getting a 24-year sentence. He will be released from prison around his 70th birthday. Brett, to this day, curses himself for not killing the man. I moved to South Florida a month or so after my rescue, much to the chagrin of my friends. I am happy here, happy anywhere that is in arm's reach of this man. I now work in the rehabilitation house with the slaves that Brett rescues. I can relate to these women, can understand their struggle, am taking classes in psychology in hopes of helping them more. My father, after being cleared from charges of assault against Menaz, has also joined the rescue business. He works with law enforcement, feeding them information we are gleaning from the girls, and they are taking down as many of the trafficking operations as possible. While Brett's practices might be frowned upon in the States, the Central American countries are turning a blind eye to any questionable methods and accepting our funding and information with open arms. To date, we've taken down 5 traders and, with Brett's previous tally included, saved over 1,200 women. It will never be enough. There will always be monsters. There will always be missing women. But it is the best therapy I could ever have, the best use of my life I could ever wish for. A part of me died in that cell, in my life as Kitten. But another part of me was born, grew, held onto the love in my heart and fought back, was freed, became a woman who married a man, a woman who reclaimed her life, and today, at 2:21 p.m., a woman who gave birth to a baby girl. I look down at my new purpose in life and smile, gently squeeze her against my chest and feel the sigh of her breath. Our baby, Elise Riley Betchart. I glance over at my husband and see the fear in his eyes. His level of love scares him. Our happiness scares him. He has gone so long with loss that I don't think he knows how not to fear, how not to worry. I reach out my hand and he grabs it, holds it tight.
This audiobook has been brought to you by Open Digital Library. To join us, just tap search. We are a community on VK. Open Digital Library. We post what others can't find.